Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Lisa Rofel, Professor of Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. On the podcast today, we have Lisa Rofel, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Santa Cruz. But perhaps in a bit of a departure for the pattern that we follow on a lot of these podcasts, Professor Rofel will be talking about a recent book which she edits and introduces, but which is actually a collection of essays by the Chinese cultural critic and Professor of Chinese Literature and Language at Peking University, Dai Jinhua, which is entitled After the Post-Cold War, The Future of Chinese History. And this was published in 2018 by Duke University Press. Dai Jinhua may not be all that well known to English-speaking audiences, but as Lisa Rofel points out in her editor's introduction to After the Post-Cold War, Dai's incisive commentaries and critiques of contemporary Chinese life have elevated her to something akin to rock star status in China itself. China's rise and its growing global presence in almost all spheres of life receives no shortage of attention from the perspective of politics, economics, science, and culture. But while reporting and academic writing on all these areas describes events of truly historic magnitude, the consequences for history itself in China and indeed worldwide are quite often overlooked. Within China, a place where it's probably not too essentialist to point out history matters a great deal, the country's dazzling recent transformations raise important questions. What's the future history that is currently being written in China? Who are its protagonists? And are any alternative historical courses conceivable? And how are recent and more distant pasts invoked or ignored in conversations about these? Based on close observation and contextualization of recent Chinese film and other cultural works, Dai offers answers to these and many other questions. This collection of piercingly insightful essays, translated by a fantastic array of experts in the field, seems especially urgent in this year of key anniversaries from May the 4th to Tiananmen, not just for understanding China in the era of Xi Jinping and his historical nihilism, or attacks on historical nihilism, I should say, but for apprehending the entire contemporary global moment, as Lisa Rofel puts it. With history in China today at once a battleground and also, as Dai Jinhua shows, an enormously and perilously vacuous space, the critique presented in this book is vital in showing us how, and Dai Jinhua puts it beautifully here, China must be a China of the future, or there will be no future. But to discuss all this and more, I'll say Lisa Rofel, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thank you very much for appearing and agreeing to introduce us to this, I think, a very important book and an incredibly important thinker. But perhaps I could begin by asking you about your own sort of trajectory towards Dai's work and how you became acquainted with her.
I actually have known Dai Jinhua since 1993. She came to the United States then to do a series of talks, and I happened to be part of a semester-long seminar at University of California on the Irvine campus. She came a seminar on East Asia, and she came and talked with us. And we immediately clicked. She was at that point a kind of rising star already of feminist theory. And so we had long discussions about women in China on that visit. And then after that, we just kept in contact. And then every time I would go to China, we would get together and talk. And I could listen to her talk for hours. And she is very eloquent. You know, the way she writes in these chapters is almost, not quite, but almost the way she speaks in just regular conversation. And so I learn an enormous amount from her every time I go, of her incredibly insightful, creative, original analyses of what's going on in contemporary China. She's just unparalleled as a thinker, critic, theorist. And so I always get together with her. I then did translate one essay. There was a previous translation about 12 years ago of her essays into English, Cinema and Desire. And I translated one of those essays. So that also then became another occasion. And we thought up this book together because she had a number of essays that she was writing that appeared to work well together. So we decided together that we would make this book happen.
Got it. I thought that's, yeah, I mean, that's certainly, I think, comes out in the book that this is based on a long familiarity in the way that you introduce and present it. I think it's a great expression of that. What about the actual kind of bringing together of everyone who worked together on the book? As I mentioned, there are quite a lot of different translators for the various essays, but all of whom in their own rights are exceptional scholars of China. How did the kind of project get brought together once you'd conceived of it?
Well, to be honest, what is that phrase in the famous movie? Depended on the kindness of friends. I pulled in personal networks of people who I knew were completely, either if they were based in the U.S., completely fluent in Chinese, or if they were not just fluent in Chinese, I should say, but understood this kind of theoretical language. Dai Jinhua is very difficult to translate. In fact, one of the translators, Mo Yajun, who is originally from China and did her PhD in the United States and now teaches in the United States, she gave this very funny paper. We did a panel on this book at the most recent Association for Asian Studies, and Yajun talked about how frustratingly difficult it is to translate Dai Jinhua. And I thought that was quite a humorous paper, because one would expect someone whose, you know, first language is Chinese would not have a difficult time. But the truth of the matter is, you need, for this kind of translation work, you need a kind of combination of, you know, a kind of wide familiarity with a broad range of academic work. And especially, of course, the kind of work that inspires Dai Jinhua. And then she herself, as you know, all languages, you're a linguist, all languages are continually inventing new terms for new historical moments, for transformations. And Dai Jinhua is one of the people inventing those terms. So you have to check in with her about exactly what she means. So I pulled on people, as I say, I knew, who are some senior people who are just their comprehension of China, especially at this level, is superb. And then there were a number of, at that time, PhD students who were fully bilingual, but who were from China. So there were a number of those also. So they, so it was that kind of combined group. And I can't thank them enough. Yeah, I can't thank them enough. It was really challenging, and I hope for them rewarding work.
Yeah, well, I think that they've done a tremendous job, because it's exceptionally lucid and flows very well, despite, as you mentioned, being concerned with some pretty weighty and detailed concepts. But we'll perhaps jump into what some of those concepts are as we move on now into the kind of body of the book. So you provide an editor's introduction to start us off, which gives us a bit of a picture of Dai's stature and her biography. But could you fill this out for us a bit in terms of what her background is, how her theoretical apparatus and thematic concerns operate as a scholar, and what her stature is really in China?
Well, maybe I should start with her stature, because she's actually quite famous in China. And again, when we did this panel at the Association for Asian Studies, just numerous students kept running up to her, especially students from China, saying, "Oh, I'm so thrilled to meet you, and I've already got your book," and because it was just for the first time being presented there, actually. And you can really see how these students from China just, they look to her for insights about how to think about, well, their own lives for one thing, and then of course what's going on today in China for another. And so she used to be a regular person. I mean, unlike the United States, where I'm located, in China, as in many places in Europe, intellectuals actually become kind of well-known television personalities sometimes. And that would be very peculiar in the United States. But so she was doing for quite some time these programs where she would be a commentator. She stopped, but, I think, and of course she teaches at Peking University, Beijing University, which is, of course, the one of the top, you could say the top university in China. So people look to those people who are intellectuals and teachers there. So she's extremely well known. And Dai Junhua came of age, really, I should say, in the Cultural Revolution. And she is deeply formed by both the inspirations from the socialist era as well as its degradations. And she then was part of that very, very selective group who managed to get into college right after the Cultural Revolution, because, of course, the universities had been closed initially, and then for some time they were only letting in a few kind of students from peasant and worker backgrounds. And Dai Junhua is not from that background, although she's not from a pre-revolution elite family either. But I understand her father was an important party official as part of the government. But she was part of that 1978 class, 77 and 78, students who had not been able to go to college for almost 10 years. There was just an enormous number of them who applied, and very, very few got accepted. And Dai was one of those students who did get accepted. So, yes, that's already an indication of her, let's call it, brilliance. I mean, she's really quite an original. I don't really believe in some ways in an original, but she really is. I mean, she's just really an incredibly original thinker. And so she went through university at Beijing University, and then she was assigned, in those days people were assigned jobs, and she was assigned to the Beijing Film Institute to teach. And so they didn't she does not make films, but there was nothing there on film theory, and she was supposed to teach it. So she basically developed their whole film theory specialization at the Beijing Film Institute. And then she managed to transfer over to Beijing University, where she created the Institute for Film and Cultural Studies. And I should say, from that background of coming of age in the Cultural Revolution and then living through all these enormous transformations in China, she's quite disturbed by some of the effects of those transformations, especially inequality, the incredible divergence now between the wealthy and the poor, so that disturbs her a great deal. And while she's not someone who wants to return to socialism, at least not in its form that it was. She does want to hold on to the ideals and the search for a better world, a more just world. And that inspiration that she grew up with still stays with her. And that motivates her concern with the issues of history and memory, which are the, I would say, the key terms, keywords of this book.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that that is the tremendous value in what she's putting across. In a way, it's retrieving or recovering something of the erasures of that socialist period that seem to be present in the way that history is looked at today in China, whilst of course not, you know, justifying or apologizing, as you put it, the degradations of that that era. I mean, that's trying to salvage something from that period. But I wonder, you mentioned in your account of how you first became acquainted that it was through feminist scholarship and her early work, which I guess was considered feminist work, that you kind of got to know her. In addition to some of this other biography that you've just outlined, this comes out in a really useful kind of appendix or a kind of postscript you have in the book about, it's an interview with her where she talks about her biography a little more. But in that, she talks about her efforts to disambiguate, if you like, her kind of feminist stance, or what has been seen as her feminist stance, particularly distinguishing between Nüxingzhuyi, a kind of feminist or female consciousness, versus Nüxingzhuyi, maybe a more Western style feminism. Is she a feminist scholar? Would you describe her in this way? And how does that angle continue to play a role in her work?
Yes, I definitely think she's a feminist scholar, and you'll hear more explicitly why when we get to talking about her current project, her new project, because Dai Jinhua never rests. She's a restless intellectual that's always motivated to comment on contemporary cultural life in China. But I think three things, really. The Nüxingzhuyi, the reason she wants to distinguish that from Nüxingzhuyi is that the latter, Nüxingzhuyi, is about rights, women's rights. And as she says in that short interview I did with her, women have legal rights in China. That's not the issue. You know, again, unlike the United States, where we've never even had an Equal Rights Amendment be able to pass into law, China does, at least technically, have an equal rights, you know, legislation and so on. But on the other hand, at least in the early 80s, after the Cultural Revolution and the beginning of all of this tremendous transformation, she felt like the issue of consciousness, of ideology, of beliefs about gender were not being addressed. And so she really wanted to concentrate on what people think a woman is supposed to be and those kinds of questions. And particularly because she in her own life felt like she didn't fit into the norm. And people were always commenting on her height, which I always find fascinating, like she's too tall for a proper woman, etc. And so that's one thing, that she wanted to focus really on this kind of consciousness issue. And then secondly, as these transformations proceeded, she also felt a little disenchanted with women's studies programs, because they were mostly focusing on urban, middle-class, professional women and what were the roadblocks in their lives. But Dai Jinhua, being very concerned, as I said before, with social inequality and some of the more disturbing aspects of these transformations, was more concerned with what was happening with women workers, women in rural areas, people who were not benefiting from these transformations at all. And so that's what led her to sort of combine kind of class and gender. She did not want to lose sight of these issues of inequality.
Mm. And in a sense, I suppose it's those issues, which, as you mentioned, are at the heart of her concerns over the contemporary moment. In light of that, perhaps I could also just ask about the title of the book, if you like. Now we've got a sense of how Dai came to some of these views about what's going on at present. What is this post-Cold War or post-post-Cold War era that we've moved into? This seems to be the key kind of temporal framing of where we're at. I think I'm fully in sympathy with it, but could you give us a bit of a picture of what is the post-post-Cold War, or what happens after the post-Cold War? What does the title mean?
She has several meanings to that title. One is, in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, there was a lot of language about, the end of history and the United States being the sole victor, and then the most importantly, the division between socialist countries and capitalist countries is over, and so that she would be characterized as the immediate post-Cold War period. What she's calling the after the post-Cold War or the post-post-Cold War is that even the Cold War has now been forgotten with this newer era of neoliberal globalization that she feels like China has jumped into. And so that gets to the second meaning, which is, in fact, we're still dealing with some of the after effects of the Cold War, but our memories and the history of the Cold War has been set aside, most especially China's role as a kind of third path between the binaries of the Soviet Union and the US, and that that effort of China to try to provide a alternative path during that period for third world and non-aligned countries is what has been forgotten. And that's why she's calling it after the post-Cold War, to highlight, again, back to the sort of main keywords of the book, history and memory, how much of history is being erased in this neoliberal globalized era.
Right, right. And well, that moves us pretty neatly into the sort of first part of the book, I think. And I should say that the book divides, it's divided into three main sort of thematic parts. So we'll go on with that, I think. In this first part and in the introduction, which Dai herself sets or uses to set up the kind of thematic concerns of the book, she talks about the way that, as you say, essentially with alternative paths having disappeared, China has entered a kind of a time frame that's very in sync with the capitalist or neoliberal West, and that the distinct 20th century experience has disappeared, she says, without a trace, in a sense. You say as well in your introduction that one of the issues that this brings up is that the West or a kind of neoliberal, quote unquote, modern world is already embedded in China and in all of its sort of thoughts about its own place in time and its future. Could you expand on that, or could you say something about what the sort of the consequences for history of this sort of move into the post-Cold War era have for China?
Well, for Dai Junhua, the 20th century represented a long, difficult search for a true alternative to the colonial West and its capitalist ventures or adventures. And she wants to hold on to that search. Again, it's not that she's wants to hold on to some congealed notion of a heroic past of the socialist era, but she does think that what has been evacuated is a memory and a historical writing of that search for a true alternative. And it's that search that she wants to hold on to, because as the subtitle of the book says, The Future of Chinese History, Dai Junhua believes that if we don't search for a better alternative, we're not going to have any future. And so she wants a different kind of history to be written about the 20th century than it what is being written, so to speak, through these film texts that she focuses on, but she places each of these films within a larger sort of public discourse about the past. And she sees total erasure. People do not want to talk about or are not talking about, I mean, everything from official histories to popular histories are not talking about this search. And so it naturalizes the current moment that this is where they're either what she calls evacuated memories or the revisionist histories, they lead up to a kind of a naturalization of the moment that we're living in. And that disturbs her a lot.
Right. And that idea of evacuated memories is present there in the title of part one, Trauma, Evacuated Memories and Inverted Histories. And in the two chapters of this part, she treats two different films primarily, first of which is City of Life and Death, or Nanjing, directed by Lu Chuan, and then also Hero, the very well-known Zhang Yimou film about the first Qin emperor. How does she use these two film texts to debate or to bring out these ideas of evacuated memories and the ways that history and versions of history are being erased in contemporary Chinese historical narratives?
With the first one, the Nanjing, City of Life and Death, she's arguing very, very incisively that the Nanjing massacre committed by the Japanese army during the Japanese colonial occupation of China before and during World War II, or what they call the anti-Japanese war in China. This film completely rewrites that history, but she starts out pointing out that this Nanjing massacre is still an unresolved trauma for people in China. That's a very, very important point in this essay, that this unresolved trauma leads to a kind of a displacement of Chinese people's sense of themselves, that they cannot have a sense of closure around that event because it's difficult, and it has been throughout since that time, difficult to address the trauma that is of that massacre for different reasons, but most recently because the Chinese government is trying to reposition itself in East Asia. And so although the government does criticize, the Chinese government criticizes the Japanese government about World War II and its lack of sense of accountability about World War II, nonetheless, the Chinese government also does not want this kind of thing brought up again. So that's one thing. But also, because she argues that the Nanjing massacre did not make the status of, let's say, the Holocaust. It's not kind of, there's no international push, not a strong one anyway, to address it. In this essay, therefore, on Nanjing, she argues that the director, Lu Chuan, rewrites that history because one effect of having this open trauma is it raises the question of what gets to count as a proper human being? What kind of person gets to count as a proper human being? And the proper human being, or let's say the human, Dai argues in a very incisive way that there's always been this tension of, on the one hand, trying to produce a socialist human being in the 20th century China, and on the other hand, the human being associated with a universal kind of person, which indirectly is always associated with the West and its Enlightenment history. And in this film, the film tends towards the universal Enlightenment version, and very paradoxically and perversely, one might even say, the Japanese soldier turns out to be the most human person in the film, whereas the Chinese, once again, she argues, get treated as passive bystanders, bystanders in this history. And so that's the
The protagonist of the film is a Japanese soldier, correct? Is the actual kind of main character that's focused on is there. And it seems, and it's striking as well, the way she outlines the fact that this film received enormous official backing and was, you know, promoted as a sort of a particularly important film for China's official narrative. So I think that's a pretty strong argument she makes.
Yes. What I really appreciate about all the essays that we've put into this book is Dai Junhua's ability to contextualize the films in a broader social, political, and cultural context. She just does that beautifully, and she certainly does that with that film. And then Hero also, you know, the famous director Zhang Yimou's film Hero, she shows how he has rewritten the history of a very ancient story about the attempted assassination of one of the first Chinese dynasties, the Qin dynasty, the king of the Qin. There were assassination attempts, and there have been many stories written about this, but Zhang Yimou's version is to perversely, again, enough, make the assassins come to respect the king's power and therefore put down their swords and stop their assassination attempts. And this rewriting of the story for Dai Junhua symbolizes the way in which people today are being encouraged to have adulation for the person with power, the hegemon, the strong man. And again, that's very troublesome for her because she wants people to be concerned about what kind of world we're building and what kinds of power relations are ensuing, and developing a critique rather than an adulation.
And I think that's a particularly poignant thing to discuss at this very particular moment. I mean, I imagine this book project was born even before the very most recent developments in China as regards adulation of certain figures. So I think that's an incredibly she's really zooming in on something especially important there. And I love the way that she outlines the place that this word tianxia, the idea of all under heaven, or this kind of old idea notion, which is applied to various things, a term which has survived remarkably unscathed, she highlights, throughout many, many centuries and indeed millennia, but which now seems to be, through film portrayals like Zhang Yimou's, kind of associated with the power of the hegemon and the conqueror, and not the masses, if you like. It's a pretty powerful and incisive point that she makes.
Well, and a point I learned about recent Chinese history in that discussion of tianxia, if I could just add, is that it was a term used during the Cultural Revolution, which I hadn't realized, to signal socialist internationalism. So tianxia, you know, of course, before the era of nation states, did signal a kind of sense of all under heaven, meaning a more without boundaries kind of connections. There were, of course, lots of divisions in earlier periods, but this was now been, as she says, evacuated of that sense of a kind of universalizing connections, and instead has been narrowed down to this, yes, the symbol of the king who represents, or the hegemon who represents, the powerful.
And that again is the strength of it. I mean, in a sense, the narrative she's fighting against is one which seeks to muddy the water, seeks to blur a lot of, I guess, elements of classical Chinese history with select parts of more recent Chinese history to provide this kind of this pastiche that is, as she critiques it, evacuated of meaning. But in her response, you know, she too is bringing to bear the socialist past, as you mentioned there, the use of tianxia during that time, as well as the deeper resonances. So she's not shying away from sweeping over this entire, you know, really, really drawing from this entire much deeper broad sweep of history in her response, and that's what makes it so powerful in many regards. Part two sees her move on to a somewhat different pair of films, if you like. The title of this part, Class, Still Lives and Masculinity, draws us into a couple of films by Jia Zhangke. That's a film known in English at least as Still Life, and Zhang Meng, the Piano in a Factory, I believe is the English name for that film, which she's a lot more positive about, really, I think it's fair to say. Particularly given that these two films focus on China's subaltern class is relatively rare in that regard for big films in China today. Could you describe sort of how she highlights or kind of evokes what she's discussing here, these ahistorical histories and the fate of the subaltern classes under neoliberal capitalism, how her critiques of these films draw that out?
Yes, I like that you mentioned these are rather positive because, yes, Dai Jinhua tends to be in the, wonderful vein in many ways of a critical theorist who tends to point out, the kind of, not exactly negative, but, to point out what gets left out and then some, negative consequences about what's going on in the world. These are two filmmakers whom she praises. And again, she makes us realize that most films coming out of China these days are not looking at the people who have been marginalized and are having difficult lives under this neoliberal dispensation. Or of, let's just say, China's entrance into global capitalism. She praises these two filmmakers because they're some of the few who actually talk about those people. So Jia Zhangke's very famous Still Life is a beautiful, beautiful, moving examination of displaced people in China. Those rural migrant workers that we hear about who move around just trying to survive and who have very difficult lives on top of the several million people who were displaced because of the building of the Three Gorges Dam. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful examination of the struggles that those people face and the uncertainties and the difficulties. And he also has great gender politics in this movie, I think, because he has the conceit that moves the story along of, on the one hand, a woman searching for her husband who's been absent in her life for a while. And on the other hand, a man searching for his wife who fled from him. And that search is what is the conceit that gets the story moving. And it's just a beautiful, and so Dai Jinhua's consideration of this is also, she's a great film critic. She picks up on details in the cinematography that I think is just so very interesting. For example, she mentions briefly what's playing on the television on the boat while people are talking to one another, and it gets, maybe I can't remember if the TV is on the boat or in another building, but it's a show that's praising Chinese leaders for having struggled for many years to develop this Three Gorges Dam project. But the point is that program is kind of sidelined and put on the margins. And then the people who are usually marginalized and who are being marginalized by these modernization projects are in the foreground of the scene. And I really love her ability to pick up on visual details like that in her analyses. So her analyses are just an extraordinary combination of zooming in on those details and then moving out to broader considerations, both in terms of context and also theoretically.
Yeah. There's a moment too where she highlights it's a fleeting moment itself as well. But there's a moment in a factory sort of boardroom or manager's office where workers are arguing with the manager under a long row of portraits of Lenin, Stalin, Mao. Or Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin, and Mao—a very, very sort of striking kind of thing. But again, the workers are in the foreground there, as you mentioned. I just wonder if I could pick up on something you mentioned there about the gender politics and this focus on the sort of former protagonists, if you like, of the socialist era and the kind of working class who were, you know, if anything, the kind of focal point of Chinese. I guess how national destiny was conceived to some extent during this latter 20th century period. How does this feed into the way that gender politics have changed, the way that she sees gender politics having transformed in more recent times, the kind of reassertion, if you like, of a different version of masculinity?
One thing that we talk about in the interview I did with her is, and one can see it, of course, this directly after the Cultural Revolution, this hyper-masculinization of social life in China and how men somehow had been emasculated, presumably, by the Cultural Revolution and needed to refine their masculinity. And also at the same time, she makes this really important comment that the critique of the era of economic reform where these transformations began, the critique kept focusing on trying to turn the enormous transformations into what she calls small problems by claiming that it was just women's problems. You know, because a lot of women initially were being laid off, although later a lot of men too, but initially mostly women. And so the displacement of a critique of what was happening to working people by talking about it as just women's issues and women should go back in the home. And there was a lot of talk about women shouldn't be, you know, doing this, that, or the other thing. And so she really has a very clear vision of that through these essays about the ways in which critiques of the kinds of inequalities that are being produced with China's entrance into global capitalism, how they get displaced onto these discussions about gender. On the other hand, this still life film, I think, is a wonderful also. The filmmaker, Jia Zhangke, is also making that same critique that these seemingly little issues of interpersonal relations, of couples being apart for different reasons, is also really at the heart of what we want to pay attention to with these some of them terrible, terrible transformations. These people's lives are so insecure, and you see buildings being destroyed as they are almost standing in them, being torn down, demolished. And also because it's become an abandoned area, that there's a lot of gang violence. And so she really picks up again on the details of that film to show how Jia Zhangke makes us enter into the kind of structure of feeling, as it were, of the protagonists in the film to imagine, you know, get us to imagine what it must be like living as a insecure migrant worker.
Right. China. No, exactly. And that's the sort of salvaging of the focus on the masses, if you like, on the broad sweep of humanity that again was supposed to be the kind of main drivers of history in the socialist period, and now of course are being kind of tossed on the waves of all kinds of forces that leaves many of them dispossessed and displaced, and similar themes, I should say, we perhaps won't have time to to dig into it now. But the second film discussed in this second part, the Zhang Meng film, also deals with some similar themes and some of these the layoffs and the impact on family relationships and so on. But I'll perhaps leave listeners to pick the book up and dig into that themselves as we move on to the third part of the book, which fascinatingly deals with spy films and the spy genre, as the part is called. What is it that's so distinctive and specific about spy films, and why do you think Dai Jinhua decides to write about these films in particular as being particularly revealing of the arguments she's making?
Well, again, her touchstone, her starting point is thinking about how history is being evacuated, how memories are being evacuated, how history is being rewritten. And the spy film genre strikes her as being a very important place for analyzing these questions. And that's because during the actual Cold War, the spy films were actually much clearer in a way about the stakes involved and questions about allies and enemies, friends and enemies. And now she's arguing the spy film genre has been reinvigorated in China, but it has a completely different texture to it, in the sense that rather than highlighting heroes and villains, the characters seem to be rather uncertain of their identities. So you get a lot of, let's say, people moving positions, which is particularly clear in the Lust Caution film and the discussions of it in China. Lust Caution, of course, was made by the famous Ang Lee, or Li Ang, and who at least US-based, I think, filmgoers are probably familiar with some of his more famous films like Brokeback Mountain. He made this film, Lust Caution, about the attempt of patriotic young people to assassinate the Chinese person who was the puppet, willing to be head of the puppet government for the Japanese. And or at least in Shanghai, not the whole country, but in Shanghai. But the story is really about this young woman who kind of changes her position as she comes to actually care for this person whom she is supposed to seduce in order to get him assassinated. And that kind of switching around, you know, Dai Jinhua, first of all, talks about the evacuation of history in the sense that these young people in the film are portrayed very vaguely as all patriotic, and so that the history of the incredibly difficult struggles between the Nationalist Party and the Communist Party is evacuated, you know, the CCP and the KMT or Kuomintang. That whole history gets evacuated in this film. So we just have these vaguely patriotic young people, and they don't have any other affiliations. So all of that gets erased. So that's one thing. And then also you get, once again, this going back to the early film about the human, you get this young woman who just wants to be a good human being. And, can't bring herself in the end, I don't know if I should say the spoiler or not, but can't bring herself to do what she has been assigned to do. And that, once again, brings out some idea of a universal human that, again, evacuates the memories of what the struggles were actually about under Japanese colonial rule.
Right, right. And this sort of point that she's making about, I guess, a very recent film concerned with spy activities and so on is made all the stronger by her tracing of the kind of a deeper inheritance of spy film spy films made, which she points out in a very interesting way transcends sort of both time and space, in that they were quite popular sorts of films on both sides of the Cold War divide, as well as in China, this sort of third space, as you mentioned, and also have endured, albeit with a couple of kind of interruptions in China, from the socialist period to the present. And a particularly intriguing dimension of this is the way, again, to allude back to something we mentioned earlier, but the way that gender politics shifts in the relationships that are present there in the spy films, and the way that the gaze is seen to operate, the way that the tension exists between having a sort of single, often male hero as the spy or the double agent or whoever, and the kind of femme fatale or the women he meets along the way. She actually provides some really brilliant critique of James Bond films as well, which I guess given my origins, I was particularly interested in. But how about this sort of shifting gender configuration that operates as spy films in China have transformed over time? How has this changed?
Yes. So the interesting thing, of course, about a femme fatale is she's often very powerful. She moves the plot along and she takes action. And whether or not she succeeds in the end, but she's a powerful presence and is an important match, let's say, for the male hero in terms of, you know, trying to outwit one another. But whereas in Lust Caution, the woman, as I say, becomes quite not exactly passive, but more a victim of her own emotions and is more of the what we would think of as a conventional portrait of a romantic vision of a young woman in many Hollywood movies. You know, so she just gives in to her emotions as opposed to, so she's not the femme fatale, she's the opposite. In fact, the whole point of the movie is that she cannot fulfill the role of the femme fatale.
So things have moved around in terms of the capacities and the sort of power balance.
Yes. And it feeds into, which Dai is concerned with, it feeds into a kind of naturalization of certain kinds of femininity that are so opposed to what Dai Junhua herself came of age with, when women were taught to be very strong and take action and take charge of their lives. And this film portrays what is a very popular vision of women today in China and gender roles about a woman who cannot, as I said, overcome the weakness of her emotions.
And it brings us back to the very early discussion we had there of her sort of desire for an elevated level of feminine consciousness rather than the rights discussion or anything like that. It's as much to do with being just able to do all these things. It's not a campaign for rights, as we were mentioning. It's a return perhaps to the idea that why not? You know, why can't women just do these things that they were generally encouraged to do in the socialist period? We'll perhaps move on to the finale, this final section of the book, which I guess draws a lot of the strands together, history, memory, and the politics of representation, as it's called. She brings up many of the themes we've already discussed here, including the focus of recent Chinese films or films popular in China on powerful men and this kind of effacing of the place of ordinary people. But in particular, she dissects the Chinese word for history, li shi, into li and shi, and the idea that li gestures at a personal experience and shi is this more grand historical narrative. I thought that was really, really smart, the way that she kind of brings that out, because it is actually a focus on individual experience that has led to a lot of the erasure of other kinds of history. So What is she sort of saying here about the relationship between history and memory, and what is her sort of outlook in this final section of the book?
Well, as we said before, Dai Jinhua is being the cultural critic throughout, in the sense that while she calls passionately for a sense that we need to recover these histories that are being erased, and we need to have a sense, especially of the kind of hope, even she uses the word utopia sometimes, a utopian desire to search for a better world. That's what she wants people to embrace. While she's emphasizing that, at the same time, she's also pointing out what she calls the vacuum of self-consciousness and values. And it's that vacuum that she really, yes, as you say, brings together the themes of the book. And she talks about this vacuum through how people end up reducing what should be emphasis on the structural conditions of history into just individualist stories, whether you're talking about the last emperor of China or most of the other films, Farewell, My Concubine, so on, that these are, then you don't get a sense of all at all of a historical context or anything else happening in the person's life except for their individual emotional responses. And this she talks about in relation, as I say, to a number of films. Assembly is one of them. And what she talks about, the blank slate of the individual, of the I, so that you can try to remake yourself into the kind of person who's going to fit ultimately into this global capitalist moment. And so there's this combination here of, critical, searingly critical commentary, along with, again, pushing us to not let go of, to recover a history where we can once again start to hope for a better world.
Right, exactly. And that kind of brings us full circle, in a sense, back to this the idea that China's experience and reflections on its past are now so entangled with a version of a sort of Western or a kind of neoliberal vision of history that makes it very difficult to see the kind of particularities beyond the microscopic sort of individual thing that ends up erasing a lot of the important aspects that she's trying to draw out. But it is, as you say, a pretty forceful and really searing call to arms, if you like, looking for something else. And I think, thank you very much for having brought it all out for us today. I should say too, as we've alluded to a couple of times, there's an interview of yours there at the end of the book, which provides a bit more context of her experience during the Cultural Revolution and development of her sort of positionality in relation to feminism and views of history and so on. And there's also a bibliography of her work included at the end of the book, which I think drives home just how extraordinarily prolific she is, and I think will provide a very good resource for anyone looking to delve into her her back catalogue more deeply. But in any case, Lisa, thank you so much for appearing. We've taken up a good amount of your time today. But perhaps before we go, I can ask a version of the New Books Network final question, namely, what is it that, either you or indeed Dai Jinhua is working on currently? What do you know of her current projects in this extraordinarily active mode that she inhabits?
Well, I had the good fortune to talk to her a lot about her new project because she came, as I said, to the United States. We did a book tour for this book, after the post-Cold War, and then ended up at the Association for Asian Studies meetings, where we did a panel on the book. So in between all those things, we talked quite a bit. Dai Jinhua has actually come back to gender in a more direct way. She's fascinated by these online novels that are a Chinese version of what was popular, still is popular, but started off earlier in Japan, which is some people translated as BL, you know, boy love. But basically, it's a genre in which straight women admire gay men in film or otherwise. But what's happening online in China is that these very young women are writing online novels about gay, or we don't have to use the word gay, but just homoerotic relationships between men. And she's fascinated about why that is. And again, being Dai Jinhua, she of course analyzes the gender aspect, but again, she also analyzes the implications these novels have for thinking about history and power, as well as gender relations. So she's writing a series of essays about this. I'm hoping we can, as I said before, eventually turn them into a book. I don't think she's published any of them yet, either in Chinese, or maybe in Chinese she has, but not in English.
Oh, well, fantastic. I mean, I hope as you suggest, that this does become something resembling the current book we've been discussing in terms of its contribution towards our understandings of China, because it seems incredibly important. So that sounds absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Lisa. I really wanted to thank you again for appearing on the show today. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And listeners, thank you too for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. It's a podcast channel on the New Books Network, and we'll be back with you very soon. Goodbye.